I'm joined today by Timothy Fitzgerald, returning to the Religious Studies Project after a few years. Tim is originally from the UK, but now based in Brisbane, where he is a visiting research professor at the University of Queensland in the Institute of Advanced Studies in the Humanities. He's one of the most prominent figures in the critical study of religion, and this interview is taking place on the 20 years since the publication of The Ideology of Religious Studies, which was a kind of watershed text in the emergence of critical religion, and that approach that we at the RSP have been pushing since day one, I guess. So first of all, Tim, welcome back to the Religious Studies Project, and thanks for making time.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. It's good to be with you.
It's been difficult to get this interview arranged, so I'm glad that it's finally happening. Let's start assuming that the listener probably hasn't read The Ideology of Religious Studies, or may not have read The Ideology of Religious Studies. Let's start with a little bit of your backstory. How did you get there from, you know, your first degree in RS, the same way that we all sort of start with whichever religion we decide to specialize in? How did you get there?
Yeah, well, there are different possible starting points, but I agree the degree in religious studies that I did at King's College London is a good place to start. Because I did that degree in 1975-77. And it was a really good degree. I learned a lot from it. I'm glad I did it. It was well taught. It was well organized in a lot of ways. And it was all about religion, right? So we had 8 or 9 courses that lasted over the period of 3 years. 3 of them were in the philosophy of religion. One was in anthropology of religion, one in sociology of religion, one in psychology of religion. And then in addition, we had to study 2 world religions. The world religions model was very well established, obviously, at that time. And that was in 70, as I say, it was in the mid-70s. Ninian Smart was very prominent, and the whole sort of religious studies education scene was pretty much dominated by the world religions model, as you know. Now, we did all of these studies of religion, and one issue which came up for me was the question of what religion actually means, because what it refers to. You know, in a lot of these sub-disciplines, like the anthropology of religion or the philosophy of religion, there's a sort of genre of writing concerned with defining what religion is. And one of the things that struck me, and I suppose anybody else who read these different approaches to the definition of religion, one of the things that struck me was that there was so much room for disagreement. That basically the meaning of religion, the reference of religion, was thoroughly contested. But that didn't lead anybody to question whether we should have departments of religious studies focused on researching a term which cannot be defined and about which there is such a degree of conflict or contestation. So that was... That was really what I came out of King's College London with. It was a very valuable thing. I think in a way it was, one could say that the degree was successful because it taught me how to reflect critically. But lo and behold, I was reflecting critically on the very category that was at the heart of all of these studies that we were reading.
Well, despite the sort of prominence of Ninian Smart's approach, it sounds like it's actually quite a methodological or at least theoretical undergraduate course, much more so than you would find in most places nowadays, I think, you know, with this sort of an entire course on philosophy of religion, an entire course on the psychology of religion. You know, I don't think courses look like that anymore.
Right. Well, it was good. Yeah, I enjoyed it. And I got a huge amount. I mean, we did a lot of philosophy. For example, we did philosophy in the sense of history of ideas, but it involved looking at particular writers, particular thinkers in some depth. This was very much the sort of Anglo-American analytical side of philosophy. We didn't study many of the French or German philosophers. Of course, Wittgenstein was very important, and one of the ways in which philosophers of religion and many others have tried to find a solution to this definitional problem is through Wittgenstein's language games, and the idea that the meaning of a word comes from its use. And those are important insights, but they don't actually, for me, solve the definitional problem. And in fact, I've had quite extended arguments about this with people like Benson Saylor, who's a great defender of Wittgenstein's family resemblance kind of approach to defining the meaning of words. But I think it has problems. So the ideology of religious studies includes a great deal of argument about the way that Wittgenstein's arguments are used to find a solution to the definitional problem. And
well, hopefully we can get to that later on. Sure. I want to walk the listener kind of to there, because I think actually the story of how you got there is quite interesting in itself. So we talked before about when you started looking at Buddhism and Hinduism, you know, after your PhD, that the lack of reference in, you know, the category of religion, it began to hit home. You began to get some sort of clear historical examples of that.
Yes. I got a job in a college of higher education, Hertfordshire College of Higher Education, in 1980. It was my first full-time job, and one of my responsibilities was to teach Hinduism and Buddhism. And when I joined, we had two degrees. One was the education degree for teachers. So there were it was a teacher training college originally, I think. And then there was a new BA in humanities, of which the study of religion provided some pretty substantial segments, courses. So I was teaching on those two. And I mean, the students would ask, you know, I was teaching Hinduism and Buddhism as a world religion, but feeling very uncomfortable with it because I could see the problems. And they're vast essentializations, aren't they, based on texts or on edited and selected versions of texts. The idea of Hinduism is taught very much in a sort of history of ideas fashion, or used to be. So there's a whole series of dates that you need to learn, and you need to learn the basic doctrines. But one thing that this complex construct Hinduism taught as a religion doesn't do is to explain the wider context in which these abstracted textual references and concepts exist. And of course, caste is a particularly problematic term. If you read world religions textbooks, you will get reference about Hinduism. You'll constantly get references to caste, but nobody explains it properly. What is caste? Mm. It's presented as though it's a sort of a kind of religious injunction on the division of labor or something. It's not the actual way in which caste operates is not really explained. And in order to find that out, you have to go into anthropology. So I was reading a huge amount of anthropology to supplement my world religion experience. Because anthropologists, and sometimes anthropologists are also interested in history, but the point is that anthropologists actually go and try and come into contact with this abstraction, caste. And at that time, particularly Louis Dumont, who wrote a classic book, Homo Hierarchicus, he dominated the field of Indian anthropology. But there were lots of other important anthropologists, Srinivas, for example. But I read a lot of anthropology, and this was in response, after all, to my students' demands, because actually a lot of the students were thinking in very practical ways and perfectly legitimately. They weren't really interested in the doctrine of salvation according to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. They were interested in why women wear a mark in their forehead, or how marriages happen, or what different people eat, or they wanted to know about the actual practicalities of the village economy. You know, how does caste actually operate within a village community? And these are very, you know, further questions that I would be asked would be, how can caste operate in huge cities like Bombay and Delhi when there are so many people? Surely your caste identity simply gets lost. These kinds of really practical and interesting questions. And here was I teaching Hinduism and Buddhism, but I'd never even been to India. And that just seemed to me to be wrong. So I organized a research trip. It wasn't brilliantly well organized, but basically my research was going to be on caste untouchability and the effect of colonial institutions, and whether the improvements and progress of liberal political economy had really helped to liberate people from the caste system. And one particular Indian leader was drawn to my attention, and that was Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. And Ambedkar became a really a source of great interest to me. So I managed to go to India for 4 months in the 1980s. I got some money together, and I just spent 4 months in India meeting people and just trying to understand what India looks like, smells like, you know, feels like.
I know that you've got an interest in Mary Douglas's work, and talking about caste there, I mean, I immediately start thinking of purity and danger, and ideas of cleanliness. And I don't know if she's, I know her ideas are applicable so much wider than simply talking about religions. And certainly the way that these kind of, well, disgust being the obvious thing, but in-group and out-group structures are kind of ritualized, but mystified in cultures.
Yes.
Immediately jumps to mind. And I know that you're a fan of her, so was that where you got to her work as well?
At first, I was getting it more from Louis Dumont, who also really belonged to the French school of sociology, l'école sociologique. He was a Durkheimian in many ways, as was Mary Douglas.
Indeed.
And Durkheim had been a big influence on me when I was doing my degree at King's College London. And for a long time, I thought of myself in a sense as a Durkheimian. And I read Dumont through a Durkheimian perspective. But Dumont was very much putting the purity-pollution binary as the kind of definition, almost the central characteristic of the caste system. So you get the Brahmins as pure and the untouchables as impure, and a whole number of other castes in between, sort of lining up in relative degrees of purity and pollution. And it's a very useful way of looking at it. Of course, there was huge debate about these things in Indian anthropology and sociology, but I think nobody would doubt that Dumont's picking on this binary is the sort of outside limits of what could be thought in terms of social or human relations, rather. But Mary Douglas came hot on the heels after Louis Dumont as one of the people that I read and one of the people that I have really enjoyed teaching. I think she's been generally really helpful. One point that I would like to make, actually, since we're talking about Durkheim, Dumont, Mary Douglas, I think you can see a kind of progressive move from the sort of empirical ethnographic approach to sociology or anthropology towards the idea of I'm calling them signaling systems. What Durkheim meant by a totemic system or a system of collective representations. What I think you get in all of these writers is a move towards reading signs and their relationships as being the fundamental point of understanding anybody's collective life.
Would you agree that it's maybe a progress from a structuralist into a post-structuralist view?
Well, yeah, I think so. But I mean, Dumont is usually considered to be a structuralist, and I think that's one of the reasons why people don't read him very much now, or they don't seem to. But I think his work is actually is very subtle in a lot of ways, and it's very rich. He also wrote, as well as Homo Hierarchicus, he also wrote a book. Well, he wrote from Mandeville to Marx, and he also wrote a collection of essays called Essays on Individualism, where he tries to show how, whereas in India, the individual is always outside the world, structurally speaking and symbolically speaking, the European Christian traditions, the individual started off as outside the world, but moved to become the in-worldly individual as a result of, basically as a result of modern capitalism, or as a characteristic of modern capitalism. Whereas individuals used to sort of go to the desert and separate themselves in a from the rest of the main body of humanity in the search for salvation or some kind of self-discovery. You know, you think of those hermits and renouncers in early Christian Europe, and they've existed all the way through. Well, in India, you get a very, very ancient tradition of renunciation, where people symbolically where people renounce their family, their village, their family name, their normal activities, clothes, profession, and really, in a sense, become a living non-person. They perform their own cremation symbolically by cremating their old clothes and various symbols of their previous life. So they become an outworldly individual. They become an individual because they separated themselves from the collective, symbolically and physically. And they've now become something rather special and sacred and powerful by moving out of the normal collective, which in India would be very much about caste membership, moving out of that and becoming a kind of individual. Actually, most renouncers in India join ashrams. They belong to some kind of an organization. They often have a guru. But nevertheless, Dumont was reading this at the symbolic level, that this is a move from identity defined by the collective to a kind of outworldly identity, an individual identity. So his story was that as a result of the Reformation and then the development of various forms of Calvinism, where there's a very strong emphasis on the lonely individual working in the world, so the individual becomes, instead of being an outworldly value, becomes the central inworldly value of modern capitalist society. I think that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Very much so. After your research on India and teaching at the Higher Education College, you then moved to Japan for 3 years. And again, this is another kind of shift in your work then. So tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, just as India had really shocked me and given me a different perspective on the world and also on myself, I think it's quite important, not for egotistical reason, but it's quite important to realize that one has internalized a great deal of shared common symbolic life, which constructs our individuality, and that when you move out of that shared symbolic life, your consciousness is quite vulnerable and you change a lot. Some people call it culture shock, but it's to do with a reorientation of values. Well, going to Japan was even more of like that, because Japan is completely different from India and it's very different from Britain. And going to Japan to live, this is because I met Noriko, my wife, who's Japanese, in London. And we had our son, James. He was born in London, but then we almost immediately went to Japan because I'd been offered a job there. And, you know, her father was asking me to go and live in Japan for a while. He didn't want to lose his daughter to a foreigner, which is perfectly understandable, you know, just suddenly disappear to London and never be seen again. So I was lucky. I was invited to go and join a university in Japan called Aichi Gakuin, which was in Nagoya. And I had to do a lot of English teaching. But I did also have a status as a research academic. Working in Japan, I had to very quickly start learning Japanese, because I didn't know a word of Japanese when I went there. And I was there for several years, and it was hugely valuable. I mean, my children are bilingual. They still speak Japanese with their mother. My Japanese was never fully fluent, but by the time I left, I could more than survive there. You know, for the last 6 or 7 years, I was living there alone because Noriko and the children had gone back to London. And that was a fantastic impetus for me. And I went there when I was over 40, I ought to add. I was like 40 years old when I first went to Japan. It's not.
And I can vouch that in your 40s, trying to learn a new language is not easy.
No, not at all, especially when it's a non-European one. But I did learn a huge amount, and I've never regretted that. I regret that I couldn't enter into academic debates with Japanese. That was just a stretch too far. You really need to be trained in Japanese language from an earlier age and do it thoroughly. But nevertheless, I learned so much, and I had so. I'll tell you, one of the main things it did was to reorientate me, as I was explaining about India. It doesn't mean to say that I idealized Japan. I was a big critic of Japan as a foreigner, you know, living in Japan. But at the same time, there are lots of things I really admired about the way Japanese people do things, the way they organize. There are lots of things that I learned from being in Japan.
One important one, though, I think, is the idea of translating categories. Japan, certainly in the conversations I have in RS, it's very useful as an example where the idea of religion in the way that we think of it generally just doesn't really work. And yet they've been kind of forced to take it on to some degree as a result of, you know, colonial forces in the 19th century particularly. And yet our Western hegemonic classifications don't really map on to Japanese society very well.
No,
would that be fair to say?
Yes, I think that is fair. Yeah, I think it's true. In fact, that's been one of the themes of quite a lot of published work on Japan, my own published work, that, you know, I, to give you a practical example, when I was teaching English in the universities, it was really boring, by the way, because most of the Japanese students don't want to learn English, and I don't blame them. I mean, why should they? They're perfectly happy speaking their own language. But also it's the way that English is taught, or languages in general are taught in Japan. So I found myself teaching a large class of 20 or 30 students who were sitting in absolutely straight lines, desks in straight lines. They would often self-gender, so you'd get the men sitting on one side of the room and the women on the other. Not always, but they quite often do that. It was a bit like an extension of the school system. You know, the Japanese school system is very disciplined, and you don't ever question the teacher. And basically the teacher is there to speak and the students are there to listen. It's very difficult under those circumstances to have a conversation class, as they jokingly used to call them. But because I was trying to develop confidence in speaking Japanese, I used to sometimes try to start a conversation in an English class in Japanese, which was a shocking experience for my students, A, because, you just don't do that kind of thing, and B, because, they had to suffer the the very unskillful pronunciations and grammatical forms that I was producing. But nevertheless, you know, it was something that I was determined to do, because I wanted to show them that I was prepared to make a fool of myself in trying to speak Japanese in front of a lot of students, that therefore I'm not going to laugh at them if they're feeling embarrassed about their English. That's not what I'm there for. I'm there to encourage and to help with communication skills, stuff like that. So in these circumstances, one of the conversations I used to like to have is, what does religion mean to you? And I would sometimes ask it in English and then ask it again in Japanese, using the Japanese term shukyo, which is the current dominant translation for religion. And the students, you know, quite often in these circumstances, nobody will reply. There's just a deathly silence. But quite often I found if I was a bit persistent, they'd say, oh, religion is Christianity. It's nothing to do with me. You know, some would say Christianity and Buddhism, religion. And I'd say, well, what about the omatsuri, the festivals? What about all your visits to the temple and the shrine? You know, are these, what about your, you know, your the way that you pay respects to your ancestors in the home, or these kinds of things? And they would just respond and say, oh, no, no, that's not religion. That's our customs. That's Japanese mm-hmm. customs. That's the way we live. So you see, there, the distinction between religion and what foreign and Japanese scholars of religion will describe as religious practices, for most people, they're not. And I think that that was something that I needed to learn, you know.
Yeah, I wonder how, I mean, there's certainly a way of looking at sort of everyday, you know, what gets called sort of lived religion or vernacular religion a lot of the time now. I'm certainly thinking about most of my kind of relatives and friends growing up in a working class area, the Highlands. That's mostly the way that they talk about religion as well. You know, religion, oh, it's the wee frees at the High Kirk or whatever. But, you know, going to speak to your gran at the grave, or, you know, these kind of ritual behaviours around 21st birthdays or Christmas time or Hogmanay or whatever, they weren't really thought of as religion. But I can't help but think if you know, there was a sort of 1930s anthropologist in that situation, he would be describing all of these as kind of primitive religious rituals.
Well, yeah, except that basically, yeah, primitive. I don't think contemporaries would call them primitive, but
No.
No, I know exactly what you mean. There's a whole tradition of making other people's practices look as though they're somehow backward, lower on the evolutionary scale, less sophisticated. But I think also there is the complication that there is a kind of meta level, say the constitutional level, the level of constitutional and the level of the judiciary concerning what religion means. And this is basically adopted from Europe. And it's quite a long story, but it involves talking about the in the mid-19th century, the Americans were becoming very powerful. They were quite imperialistic. The United States of America, which had liberated people from the tyranny of a European monarch.
I want to pick that up at the start of the next interview.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't think we've got time to do it justice now.
It's a very long one. That it's because I think we need to talk about the way in which religion became inscribed in the U.S. Constitution.
Absolutely. So we'll pick that one up there in the next episode. But for now, let's just whilst you're in Japan, you wrote the Ideology of Religious Studies. So tell us just a little bit about the overall argument there. I mean, certainly reading that as a, I was either towards the end of being an undergrad or the start of postgraduate studies. It was the first sustained argument challenging, you know, religions, world religions, the phenomenological approach, which had been so sort of central to the way that they taught Edinburgh. Briefly sum up where you were when you wrote that monograph.
Well, as you say, I was in Japan, and it was the culmination of, I'd been publishing about Japan during the 90s. For example, I was reading books on Japanese religion in English, but written by Japanese scholars who had either written it in English, their contribution in English, or it had been translated. But one thing that struck me, there was one particular volume which was quite authoritative. I mean, it had been published and financed under the auspices of the Ministry of Culture in Japan, and the there were, I think, five or six professors who contributed special chapters to it, one on Japanese Buddhism, one on Japanese Shinto, one on Japanese Confucianism, one on Japanese nature religion, one on folk religion, and one or two others. Though, yeah, one on Christianity in Japan, I think. Very few Christians in Japan. But now what struck me about all of these writers was that, A, they were all specializing in a particular religion or a particular religious tradition, which they set out to describe for the reader. But at the same time, every single one of them said that actually this is a very artificial distinction, because really you can't talk about Shinto without talking about Confucianism and Buddhism, and the same with the others, because they're all part of our lives. We don't really choose between them. It's not as though I'm a Shintoist but not a Buddhist, and the idea that I'm not a Confucianist is difficult to swallow. You know, the point is that there was a contradiction inherent in what they were saying, and it was the same contradiction that I'd encountered in India in a particular way, but also in the definitional problems in the degree that I did, that there was a disparity between what people were saying in one part of the text and what they were actually saying in another part. So my first article about Japan was published, in the early 90s. Was it 93, 94, 95? It was called Japanese Religion as Ritual Order. And what I was trying
1993,
okay. And it was published, I think, in Religion.
Yep.
I was trying to point out this, what I've just told you in that article. I called it Japanese Religion as Ritual Order because I was trying to find a term which would give me some kind of a base, and ritual seemed to be a very useful one, because ritual, we can use the term ritual to describe either side of the binary. You know, you can have religious rituals and secular rituals, but ritual was a term which I hoped I would be able to use in order to avoid using this binary religion secular. Because it didn't seem to me to work. So I looked at all the ways in which the Japanese ritualize their everyday lives in all the institutions, in the household, in the schools, in the universities, in the corporations, in the small businesses, in the services. Every institutional practice is a ritual which constructs seniors and juniors. That's one of the things it does. It's imbued with respect language and different levels of language. There is an issue about social space, so people distance themselves in a certain way. Bowing is an obvious example of the ritualization of everyday life. I wanted to try and subvert this essentializing dichotomy between religion on the one hand and the rest of secular life on the other, and showed that it's much more like a ritual continuum. And that went in very much to the ideology of religious studies.
For me, the most kind of impactful realization in it was the kind of the critique of phenomenology, the phenomenological method as kind of essentialist and maybe even crypto-theological, together with the sort of larger critique of the category as essentially kind of without that kind of essence to it, without some sort of, like it, the term was essentially meaningless unless it's referring to this sui generis kind of essence. And that for me was the most impactful part of that argument. Don't know if that was central for you, but that was certainly.
Yeah. I think of course it is central. Yes. I mean, one of the points of my arguments was that religion is actually used to describe and classify so much that it becomes empty of any specific content. And if you look at the actual range of usages of the term religion, there's a religion of everything. And yet at the same time, it's in this either-or essentializing binary with the non-religious secular. Now, there's something very interesting there, that on the one hand, you've got a category which can be used so widely that you begin to wonder, is anything not religion or religious? But on the other hand, it's held together in this essentially either-or binary. It's either religion or it's not religion, which gives it the appearance of having a very determinate and definitive reference. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it also raises the question about, if we can't define the religion side of the binary, then we can't find the limits of the secular side either. And religion, my work in the ideology of religious studies was very much about destabilizing politics and society. Society is the generic abstraction for sociology. And a lot of the stuff was aimed at Ninian Smart, but also much more widely. I mean, I discussed a lot of different theorists in the ideology of religious studies. I wanted to undermine these grand dichotomies, but as soon as you question the limits of the secular, then you're also questioning politics or the idea of society or the idea of culture.
And that's exactly where we're going to pick up in the next part of this interview. But for now, thank you, Tim.
Okay, thank you, David.
The RSP is sponsored by the British Association for the Study of Religions, the North American Association for the Study of Religion, and the International Association for the History of Religions. The Religious Studies Project is produced by the Religious Studies Project Association, SCIO, a Scottish charitable incorporated organisation, charity number SC047750.
Brought to you by founders and editors-in-chief Chris Cotter and David Robertson, and managing editor Thomas J. Coleman III. Our features are edited by Marek Sullivan and Rebecca Barrett-Fox, and our Opportunities Digest by Ella Bock. Podcast transcription by Helen Bradstock, with audio editing by Gregory Schneider and Samuel Ward. Social media managed by Ray Radford, sales and marketing by Sammy Bishop, and video editing by Jonathan Tuckett.
Don't forget, you can support the project by using our amazon.com.co.uk and .ca links, or donating at patreon.com/projectrs. And you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, iTunes, and other portals.